Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
My name is Nick Peterson, and I am the Vice President of Business Development for LifeCube Incorporated. As many of you already know, the effect a disaster has on a community goes far beyond the destruction of property and infrastructure. Of course, Santa Barbara is very familiar with this fact. After the Tea Fire burned down more than 230 homes just 6 months ago, the Hesseceta Fire took us by surprise last week, forcing the evacuation of 30,000 of our friends and neighbors, burning almost 9,000 acres, and reducing 79 homes to ash and rubble. Personally, I must say that I was extremely proud of our community to see how we came together to help one another in our time of need. While I was working at the Red Cross shelters this last week, I saw that we are a community that is not only empathetic, we are also willing to put forth whatever effort is required. However, no matter how much we are willing to give, the fact remains that current methods of response are inadequate in several serious ways. During the evacuations, the local hotels filled quickly, shelters became overcrowded, and first responders did not have the accommodations they required. Now imagine, if these problems were so readily exposed in such an affluent segment of the country, how might a disaster affect the rest of the nation? Here, 800 plus of the 30,000 evacuees were sheltered by the Red Cross. How much would that number have grown if most evacuees could not afford a week's worth of hotel accommodations or travel expenses to a friend or relative's home? Here, 79 homes burned down. How many would have had adequate insurance elsewhere? How much would they require in government aid to rebuild their home? Would that aid be enough to rebuild and find interim accommodations? These are questions that must be asked. California has obviously entered the fire season early. The Gulf Coast will enter hurricane season in a month or two, and our country will be required to provide relief. 10 days after Hurricane Katrina struck, the federal government approved FEMA's request of $2.5 billion for 140,000 trailers at approximately $18,000 each to serve as temporary shelters. Never mind that many had toxic levels of formaldehyde, the cost per unit was much too high. Drawing from an already strained federal budget, spending $2.5 billion on a temporary solution was highly irresponsible. Because so much money went towards supplying the victims with these temporary living situations, the budget left over for the rebuilding effort was meager, to say the least. So the victims were given a house, told that it was only temporary, and then offered little or no help to rebuild their home because the budget was already used up. Needless to say, many realized that they could do nothing because they lacked the resources. So they have continued to live in these temporary shelters for 4 years and struggle to even pay their bills. On May 1st, 4,800 families still living in these trailers were given an eviction notice and will be forced out at the end of the month. Where will they go? Clearly, the FEMA trailers were not a solution. They were a second disaster. But now, there is an alternative. I am pleased to introduce to you the LifeCube, a semi-permanent portable shelter that will dramatically enhance a dangerously out-of-date disaster relief industry. The LifeCube arrives as a durable 4-foot shipping container made entirely from post-consumer recycled plastic pallets. The shipping container unfolds to form a 12-foot square platform raised 6 inches off the ground. Inside the container is a table and user-specific equipment and an inflatable tent with an included canister of CO2 that inflates the tent to create a 144-square-foot shelter. Unfolding the floor, inflating the tent, and securing it to the platform takes approximately 3.5 minutes. A shelter that can be established almost instantly in remote locations will eventually find many applications in a variety of industries. However, we have chosen the disaster relief industry as our point of entry due to the obvious customer pain and clear financial opportunity. To add to our credibility as a startup, I am proud to say that we have entered into a tentative partnership with the local Santa Barbara chapter of the American Red Cross. They have publicly endorsed our product as a preparedness, response, and recovery tool that addresses the unique problems of disaster relief. We hope to grow this local partnership into the national Red Cross which will help us in penetrating a domestic market that consists of Direct Relief International, the Office of Emergency Services, FEMA, the military, local municipalities, corporations, and consumers. To use the HESA Seat of Fire as an example, not only could life cubes have been used as overflow at the Red Cross shelters, they could have been brought to Earl Warren Showgrounds or other safe zones around the perimeter to serve as either a mobile coordination center for CAL FIRE to manage the response or local sleeping quarters for the firefighters ending their 20-hour shifts. Had this happened, the response effort would have been more efficient while providing our first responders with the comfort and convenience they need and deserve. However, after response comes recovery. Through governmental aid, Red Cross assistance, or insurance coverage, those whose home has been destroyed by a disaster must keep the rebuilding effort at the forefront. The cost-effective pricing of the Life Cube will allow disaster victims to remain on their property in a comfortable shelter as their home is being rebuilt. The unit comes complete with a stable floor, table, food, water, communications, first aid, warmth, bedding, sanitation, and wash station, all of the required necessities to sustain life as a foundation is rebuilt. The savings the Life Cube offers will allow the focus to shift from temporary solution towards the permanent answer. Due to the uncertain nature of disasters, it will be necessary to maintain an inventory of units to respond quickly to in fulfilling our purchase orders. While maintaining an inventory is costly, it will not be cost prohibitive for three reasons. First, a short first production run will generate a cost of goods sold of only $4,500 per unit. Therefore, a comfortable gross margin of 40% can be made while still maintaining a very competitive $7,500 per unit. Larger production runs, more efficient procedures, and strategic partnerships will reduce this cost further and increase the gross margin. Second, the inventory represents an investment. When a disaster is declared to be a state of emergency, the federal government will reimburse state agencies up to 93% for their equipment purchases. By having access to a large inventory, these state agencies will be able to buy units almost free of charge. Third, the inventory will be partially funded with revenue obtained from our corporate leasing program. Corporations are required to have a disaster contingency plan to ensure the safety of their employees, and they will satisfy this requirement with a Life Cube lease. Under a 5-year leasing agreement, corporations will pay monthly premiums of $150 per unit. At the end of the lease, the corporation will have the option to either return the unit or keep it for an additional payment of $1,000. The revenue per cube is increased by 20% under the operating lease and allows for a second round of sales on the same unit. Otherwise, the capital lease generates 33% revenue markup per unit. Already, we are in communication with a major Southern California biotechnology company who is intrigued by the idea and excited by its feasibility. Though maintaining an inventory may require a substantial upfront investment, the opportunity it allows dramatically diminishes the cost. Based on comparable industry data and custom equipment requirements, we predict the startup cost to be $750,000. The current capitalization of the company is 76% to the founders, leaving 24% available for investment. The founders are composed of the president, Michael Connor, the vice president of operations, Brian Bargo, and myself. We are all working for sweat equity and eagerly await a capital investment to begin operations. Conservative financial forecasts indicate a loss in the first year when startup costs are carried over, but break-even will occur in the first quarter of year two. Due to startup costs, we will postpone inventory of product in the first year, but beginning in year two, we will inventory the equivalent of 10% of all units sold quarter by quarter. Sales and marketing expenses are 10% of the total revenue, while administrative and general expenses are each 5%. Cost of goods sold are expected to decrease, and sales are expected to increase as we continue to grow market share and tap into foreign markets in year five. The Life Cube was designed to fill a need that is desperately lacking and potentially fatal to dismiss. While we are still not prepared to respond to disasters in the 21st century in an efficient, timely, and complete way is anyone's guess. Thankfully, LifeCube Incorporated has the answer. With LifeCube, help is inside. Thank you.
You didn't cover the competition, so could you talk about competition and highlight ways in which your product is better than the competition?
Okay. Right now, our competition is the FEMA trailer for the long-term solution. But for the short term, and sometimes it actually ends up being longer, certain places will set up a tent city. If you saw pictures from the earthquake in Italy, what they do is they will house hundreds and thousands of people in military-grade canvas tents. Now, these have no insulation, a floor consisting of either dirt or a tarp, and they come with no included equipment. There are also other competitors, as you saw in the business plan, such as Zumro. Zumro is a inflatable manufacturer, but again, they don't have any included equipment, and their focus is primarily on hazmat situation, decontamination shelters. So I would put at the top of the list FEMA trailers and canvas tents. And we fit right in the middle with cost and far and above with equipment.
Have you ever have you had the time or the market research work done to contact a kind of a diverse group of companies to find out if they would be interested in just, in a sense, stockpiling four to six of these? I'm thinking of somebody who might have a plant site. If something prevents employees to get there or people who happen to be stuck there and can't get home, it would act as shelter for them. Have you talked to anybody about that?
Just out of curiosity? I can't mention any names because it's still preliminary. Mm-hmm. Nothing's on paper yet. But we have been talking to a local biotechnology company.
Oh, okay.
We're very excited about the opportunity that shows.
What kind of requirement does such a unit like this have to have from a testing point of view to meet federal standards?
GSA testing. Our manufacturer of the inflatable tent has been making Navy life rafts for 50 years, so they have plenty of inroads to the proper testing. They're really excited about our product. In fact, they have dedicated 1,600 square feet of their new facility to LifeCube manufacture. The pallet manufacturer for the floor has made equipment for the Air Force. So again, they also have GSA testing inroads. If we want to get into the military grade, we will have to have very stringent military specs.
Can we do a little math together here? This is a working capital question. So $4,500 per unit for your first units you're going to build. So if I'm doing my math right, your $750,000 startup money is a little under 200 units. And until you start selling or leasing them, you have to carry that capital cost. It's called a working capital expense. So how are you intending to finance building the first number of units before you either have significant sales or leases?
Yeah. We are very lucky to have manufacturers that firmly believe in our product. We have received this prototype that we've had for about a month and a half, 2 months now, and they fronted that cost. So we are kind of the second wind for our manufacturers. A lot of interest has been drummed up by them, and they will extend a line of credit to us. But right now, we are looking for that Series A investment financing. To carry over those costs.
So just as a follow-up, in terms of capital allocation, how much of your initial funding do you expect will be working capital costs?
We would like to start an initial product run of about 25 units. We will use those primarily for testimonials and press. You know, we have received a lot of press already through Wired magazine. The Independent just ran an article on us the other day. Of that $750,000, we would like to have 25 units made initially.
Give him information about what's inside of the unit. I mean, other than the tent, you talked a little bit about that, but the costing and what's involved in that.
Now, we call it end-user specific because there will be different applications for the cube. It'll either be a shelter, and in that case, it'll have bedding, food, water, different rations, the camp toilet, of course, materials such as that. But if it's for, say, a first responder, like a firefighter, it'll have a heavy emphasis on equipment they need and communications gear. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, our primary things are food, water, shelter, communications, first aid, bedding, and the like.
How much of that is in your initial cost, your 40...
$4,500? About $1,000.
Okay. What about for climate? You know, it's one thing you might need in, you know, in the southern states and so forth, and all of a sudden if you've got a catastrophic earthquake in the winter of Colorado or someplace like that, is there...
We have an interior wood pellet stove that provides heat from the inside. But one of our primary product technologies is the walls. The prototype right now doesn't show this, but the walls will be 2-ply with 6 inches of dead air space.
Oh, okay.
That actually provides a very good,
good
insulating R-factor.
Good.
Yeah, R factor of roughly 40, 45. Mm-hmm. So it's comparable to a home. Mm-hmm.
Let's say you have to move the tent once it's up. The fire moves, and they want. You said it takes 3 minutes from pallet to
3.5. Yeah,
opening up. So, but to close it and put it back in a pallet form, and what's the process involved in that?
We've deployed it probably about 15 to 20 times now, and. We can usually get it back in the box in about 10 minutes, sometimes 15.
How many people?
About three. Two, if need be.
Could the occupants, would there be sufficient training or a little book there to show the occupants how to do that themselves?
I mean, we have designed this to be able to be deployed in the dark, in the rain, low visibility situations.
Right.
With no prior knowledge of the product itself. More or less, you unfold the cube, and you pull the cord to turn on the CO2, and the shelter inflates itself. Then you just strap it down to the pallet with a perimeter bungee.
Mm-hmm. How essential is a flat surface for the construction versus somewhat hilly terrain?
It's more of a comfort issue. You know, if you're on a hillside, you'll be on a hillside in the shelter. But... it's not essential, but it is preferred.
How strong winds are you expecting for this to stand up to?
High gusts. You know, of course, not gale force winds. Mm-hmm. But we do have an internal infrastructure that actually gives it a pretty good wind and snow load support. And when it is fully inflated, it is, you know, very good under high winds. Like, we had it up during these recent Santa Anas, and it held up very well.
Do you have to maintain the inflation, or does it hold it very well? Do you have to top it off?
The material that the infrastructure is made out of, the inflatable infrastructure, is the same material they make Navy life rafts out of. So it's not gas permeable. I mean, it will lose pressure after a while. Right now, we've inflated it so many times with CO2 that it has received some stress cracks, but that's because we don't have a diffuser in there or whatever.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Alexander Stanisic. I am Chief Technical Officer of ExcelMed Technologies. On behalf of ExcelMed Technologies, I'd like to thank all of you tonight for being here, including the audience and the judges. We'd also like to thank the Technology Management Program for providing us this outstanding opportunity. Tonight, ExcelMed Technologies will be presenting the Baby Beacon, an infant movement monitor that aims to reduce the risk of sudden infant death syndrome, also commonly known as SIDS. Every year, 2,500 infants die suddenly of SIDS. This equates to one death out of every 2,000 births annually in the United States. This makes SIDS the number one leading cause of death for infants 1 to 12 months in age. There are numerous causes for SIDS. However, it is generally agreed upon that infant sleep apnea, the cessation of breathing during sleep, is the leading precursor to SIDS. The unpredictability of SIDS is a great cause of anxiety and restlessness for parents every time they put their children to sleep. According to a consumer survey online, 80% of parents are concerned about SIDS, while 90% of parents check their children's sleeping, breathing patterns in the middle of the night. We at Xcelement Technologies are aware that we will never be able to fully alleviate all the worries that parents have when it comes to their newborns. However, with the Baby Beacon, we will supply the need of parents to have a safe and reliable alert mechanism to warn parents of a parent's life-threatening events. Parents concerned with SIDS will be seeking a clinically tested device that does not restrict monitoring just to the infant's crib. The Baby Beacon will be the clinically tested and portable monitoring solution that parents have been looking for and that they deserve. In June of 2008, our VP of Research and Development and I, and myself, won Most Remarkable Design at the Mechanical Engineering Capstone Design Competition. What we showed was a proof of concept that an infant chest band can accurately monitor infant breathing chest movements. To date, we have filed for a provisional patent and are currently working on our functional prototype. Once our functional prototype is completed, we will be testing our prototypes at the neonatal intensive care unit at the Santa Barbara College Hospital. After the completion of these clinical trials, we will acquire a utility patent, and we will also acquire an underwriter's laboratory certification to ensure that our product will be market ready. Now, I would like to introduce Joseph Marcus, our Chief Operations Officer. He is here today to talk to you about our growing industry and that we'll be entering, as well as the investment opportunity here at Xcelement Technologies.
These are the technologies that are available today for retail and monitor your infant's movement at night. Now, they're designed to be placed underneath the mattress and monitor motion through the mattress, but we feel that this is a passive monitoring service for alerting parents about a life-threatening disease or case, because we want to be able to detect the motion through direct contact of the chest. Now, they're prone to false alarms because of this passive mechanism, and this is also called a false positive in the medical community. They're very limited in portability because they can't be used outside of the crib setting, and they need to be hooked up to a power source in order to have any functionality. Now, lastly, they need to be used completely flat, which also inhibits their use. And most importantly, parents are very reluctant to purchase these products because they have no backing from the medical community. Xcelement is aiming to attain this certification. This is our product solution. We'll be technically superior to all motion monitors on the market, and we'll be a 24-hour monitoring capability that can be used in the crib at night as well as in the day during play. So, as the only band, we will differentiate ourselves and become the industry leader with the following technical superiorities. Now, the Baby Beacon will be the only motion monitor with cardiac monitoring capabilities. And so, in the case of obstructive apnea, where there's a foreign object inhibiting normal breathing patterns, the heart rate will begin to drop below 80 beats per minute. And at that point, this monitor will send a wireless signal to the receiver, letting caregivers know that they're having a life-threatening event with their infant. And secondly, the Baby Beacon will be the only motion monitor that is 100% wireless. It's a freestanding band made of neoprene, and it's highly elastic, durable, and non-allergenic. Now, our third competitive advantage is that our receiver is placed on this docking station. However, it merely holds the receiver in place. It's easily worn as a watch, or put around your neck like a necklace, and it provides a radius of about 300 feet of activity space, and the alarm will also sound if the caregiver exceeds this radius. Lastly, and most importantly, the Baby Beacon is planned to go into clinical trials right here in Santa Barbara's neonatal ICU. This will show our parents that we are the reliable source and preventative solution for life-threatening events. Now, the Baby Beacon will be entering a $6.4 billion industry called the baby durables industry. And there are also many other. The baby durables industry is a highly lucrative market because these products are partially recession-proof. And according to Mintel Market Research, only 19% of parents claim that they do not own an infant monitor. Now, according to Consumer Reports, the average middle-income family, age 25 to 34, will spend about $12,000 on their infant up to age 3. Within the first year, however, $8,000 is spent on this infant. Now, annually, there are 4 million babies born in the United States, and we have focused on specific niches to market to and target. Now, firstly, over 50%, about 2 million babies, are first-time children. Now, their parents are least experienced about what it takes to care for an infant and therefore experience the highest anxiety for SIDS. Secondly, 12% of all of these children are premature. That's about 500,000 babies born. Now, these children are usually at-risk children diagnosed with cases of sleep apnea or asthma, which necessitates high monitoring once they're discharged from an NICU. Additionally, the Academy of Pediatrics has stated that 20% of all SIDS cases occur in the daycare setting. Therefore, since 70% of all parents say that they use these services, it behooves us to market to this population, and by the Baby Beacon being deployed in these environments will ensure that we can have a reliable and safer place for parents to leave their child. Lastly, friends and family become an instant advisory board for expected parents about which baby durable products to purchase, and they often become a potential purchaser of our product through infant registries and baby showers. Now, our business revenue model will deploy in 3 distinct phases. First is launch. We'll rely heavily on our website to sell directly to our consumers and market heavily through e-commerce websites such as Amazon.com, Buy.com, and BabyCenter.com. Second is retail. We will begin to partner with retail consumer stores such as Walmart, Kmart, and Target. And these 3 establishments account for about 53% of all revenues in this baby durable industry in the U.S. Now, during expansion, we'll begin to extend our product line, adding visual and audio capabilities to our traditional cardiac and motion sensing technology. We'll also enter into growing lucrative markets, such as senior sleep apnea. And we'll also provide an FDA-approved monitor for our device. Now, we're asking for a $500,000 commitment to produce the Baby Beacon. The first stage of $250,000 will enable us to obtain full corporate status, finalize utility patent, complete the prototype, and become UL certified for wireless components. We'll also hire a chief executive officer and deploy a marketing strategy. The second stage, coming about 1 year later, will help us manufacture the first 3,000 units and cover any unforeseen necessary expenses. As you can see, and stated in our business plan, we intend to have a gross profit of about $10 million by year 2013, but this is taking in consideration a 1.5% conservative market penetration. At this point, we're thanking our advisory board. It's because of their help that we can bring to you this exciting investment opportunity, tremendous, exciting technology. Also, thank you to Dr. Turner, our principal investigator for our clinical trial, as well to College Hospital's neonatologist, Dr. Barkley, for overseeing this clinical trial. Now, the Baby Beacon will save infant lives and will be the signal for infant safety. It is actually a $250 product that will be a differentiator because it's the only product that has an elastic band for an active reading. At this point, we would like to say thank you to the audience. We'll answer all questions after this presentation, and will now open the floor to further discussion about the baby beacon. Thank you.
What about this? The cardiac monitoring capability here.
Mm-hmm. It's not on there.
Pardon me?
The cardiac monitor is not on.
Tell me about that. Is it just beat, or what do you derive from it?
What we derive is the heart rate.
Just the heart rate.
Just the heart rate. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay.
When you're monitoring heart rate, as long as you're just monitoring heart rate and sudden changes in heart rate, it falls under Class 2 FDA certification.
Right.
But the second you start going into asphyxia, I believe it's called, right, you will have to go under Class 1.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're just doing is we're monitoring heart rate, and once the heart rate goes above or below a certain level, we want to alert the parents.
So tell us how it works, how it actually detects breathing and how you actually detect heart rate.
Well, the way it detects breathing is actually one of our patentable secrets, I guess you could say. We did file for provisional patent. What the sensor does do, it just detects the motion of the infant's chest, and once the motion succeeds for 20 seconds or more, the parents are alerted. Now, the heart monitor is a totally separate sensor that just takes into place heart rate. So you have two different sensors working, one for breathing and one for heart rate. So that ensures that no matter what kind of apnea hits the child, whether obstructive or central apnea, the parents will be alerted.
One of the issues, your competitor's analysis, is that none of those are in contact with the baby. This product
Yes.
is in directly contact. Do you see any safety issues related to that?
We're using it for infants from ages of 0 to 12 months, and we've had concern in our market research that the baby's going to roll over on top of it, but a baby from 0 to 8 doesn't really move much, so we don't see a problem with that. The band will be placed under the arms of the infant around the chest, and it's highly unlikely that it could cause strangulation. And the housing on the final product will be waterproof and electrical proof. It's not going to cause any sort of electrical shock to the infant. So on higher-end apnea monitors in hospitals and at home that are FDA-approved now, they use a chest band as we do, but they're not wireless, and they use electrocardiogram signals and other types of ways of sensing for apnea. And they also are attached in the same way we do, but they have wires coming out going to a modem that's collecting all the data.
Obviously, a product like this has to be unbelievably safe before a parent's going to put them on their child. So what kind of market research have you done to establish that your design is safe in terms of not coming off, not strangling the child, all the things you talked about, electrical shock? What kind of market research you've done to determine that this particular design is perceived to be a highly safe design?
I'll answer this question. We've been following the FDA guidance to industry for sleep apnea monitors, and so that's been taken into consideration in the entire design, including the cardiac rates of when it reaches below 80 beats per minute for 5 seconds, as well as cessation of breathing for 20 seconds. Those are the industry standards, as well as other electrical components that will enable us to be a certified FDA product.
Are those for infants or adults, those standards you just described?
These are for both.
Let's talk about the alarm it gives to the parent. How far away is there a different alarm for heart than breathing, or what is the how are they? Is it a battery?
Well, basically, the alarm acts both as a visual and an audio alarm. The beauty of this is that our receivers could be portable, and so the parents could leave it on their stand, or they could wear it as a watch or a necklace, so the parents will never have to be worried about being out of earshot of the actual alarm itself. As for what kinds of different alarms, we're currently doing research on whether heart palpitations or breathing cessation should warrant different kinds of alarms. We're doing research right now on what parents should actually do once the alarm goes off. We were told by the neonatal intensive care center at Santa Barbara College Hospital that the first thing parents should do is stand back and make sure that no objects are blocking the child's breathing. So, both the heart and the breathing monitor are both made kind of just to make sure that the baby is functioning. So, we're still trying to look into that.
What's your predictions and cost and time frame for UL approval on such a product?
Did that run?
We're not going for FDA approval.
No, I said UL approval.
UL approval. We estimated around, I believe it was around $25,000 that it would cost. And we were going to approve it around October after the entire design of the product was completed, and we could patent it, file the utility patent first before we send it off for a UL certification.
You mentioned you're somewhere in prototype. Can you give us a little more color around that? How far have you gone in prototype development? What kind of testing have you done? Sizing, performance?
We've programmed the logic used inside of like microprocessor type of thing. We use a field programmable gate array and a program called Cortis to hook up our sensor and write computer code that simulates electronics for how the alarm will go off. And on a computer program, we can change how long motion stops before an alarm goes off. And we've done things with that, and we tested sensitivity. We'll be working on putting the wireless technology together. I've done some research and also tried to build a couple things. Not very experienced in mechanical engineer, so I've been working on learning about wireless technology. Working on that, once we get the wireless technology, we'll integrate the motion sensor and then the cardiac monitor, and then we should have a functional prototype by the end of July.
Just assuming you have an experiment on your own younger brothers and sisters, have you tried this on some living creature to see how it works?
We have not. We plan to.
In relationship to that, you talk about clinical testing. What is involved in your clinical testing, and is it requiring an IRB type approval?
Oh, yes. Our clinical test will require an IRB approval. Our product is listed under non-significant risk, so we won't be able to. So we won't have to let the FDA know that we want to conduct clinical trials.
Okay.
And if the IRB sees so fit that we are non-significant risk, then they will allow us to test in the neonatal of intensive care units. What those extra tests will be like. We'll have our wireless monitors on the infants. What the head of the NICU told us was he'll put it on two babies that are prone to apnea events, and then our monitor will wirelessly send data to a data collection unit, and then we will just collect the data, and as an apnea event happens, our monitor will note that but will not send out an actual alarm. And we will get the data from their current monitors, and we will look at both the hospital monitors and our apnea monitor and ensure that we are indeed detecting apnea events.
You said that this will be around the baby's chest or around the arm?
Around the chest.
So if the baby is sleeping on his stomach, it seems like there'd be discomfort.
Oh, yeah, that's one thing we didn't mention. Studies have shown that laying an infant on its back reduces the chance of SIDS. Like a few years ago, someone suggested to lay your child on your back, and it significantly reduced the amount of SIDS cases. So in our instruction manual that come with the product, we're going to suggest that you lay the infant on its back. It's a second safety measure.
I'd also like to add, as of 2003, there is a new national campaign for the back to sleep movement, which highly suggests for healthcare practitioners, also daycare centers, and parents to place their child on their back for sleeping.
Thank you very much.
I'm Chris from Profound, and I've got bad news. 30 of you will lose your phones. 38 of you will lose your keys. 15 of you will lose your wallets. Sorry to be the bearer of bad news here. It's just a statistical fact. And oh yes, everyone in this room will misplace one of these three items by the end of the year. and there's nothing you can do to prevent this from happening. It's fate. That is, unless you have Profound's solution. Here at Profound, we use technology to prevent loss from happening. Let me emphasize this point. There are products out there that will help you locate your items after you find them. We guarantee you will never lose your items. It's like applying sunscreen versus using aloe vera to a sunburn. We prevent loss in item misplacement. Let me show you how we do it. We have a small device that can attach to your keys, go inside your wallet, or attach to numerous other items. We then have software that runs on smartphones, such as the BlackBerry and iPhone. This software tracks the distance between the keys, such that if it were to become separated by user-definable distance, the phone will ring on loud setting, alerting the user that they might lose their phone, keys, wallet, or any other personal items they wish to protect. We have already filed a full utility patent with a patent lawyer. And just so you guys know that this isn't some PowerPoint magic, let me show you the item right now. This software is running on the phone right now. We are tracking the distance between the keys. As you see, when I become separated from the device, just a little always something there to remind you. Now, just for a usage scenario, here's our friend Frank. Now, unfortunately, Frank is not a Profound customer. And he's going to pick up his boss from the airport today, where his boss will call him on his BlackBerry, giving him the time and place to pick him up. And now, unfortunately for Frank, Frank forgets his BlackBerry behind. Now, Frank didn't pick up his boss from work. And, unfortunately, lost his job. Sorry, Frank. Now, here's Christian. Christian, he's a Profound customer. Now, when Christian goes to pick up his boss from the airport, he knows he's protected by Profound. As you see, he walks away, and ring, 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 his phone alerts him that he's about to forget behind. Now, Christian's up for a promotion at work, and is more confident in knowing that he's safe with Profound. And I know what you're all thinking. What if the system fails? What if you don't hear your phone ring? We got you covered. Your phone will automatically lock down with a longer password and detect that it has been separated. It will also display a user-defined safety number, such that whenever someone finds your phone, they go and hit a few keys and dials your home phone up so you can get the phone back the very next day. In version 2.0, we'll also incorporate advanced GPS features to give you even more protection. Now, who's our market? Simple. Anyone with wallet, keys, and a smartphone. Right now in America, there's 66 million smartphones, and this number grows every day. But within this large market, we're going to target these three niches. First is loss-prone smartphone users. These users lose a phone once every 2 years on average. Next is business travelers for their high reliance on BlackBerries and iPhones. Finally, companies with large mobile workforces like IT companies and sales professionals. We talked to these IT companies and they told us that when their engineers just forget their phone behind for the day, they're working at 20% productivity. This costs these companies money. Now, distribution will be initially direct and through our website. We'll utilize the smartphone app stores, as well as conventional retail. We have already set up distribution through Kaler World Traveler with 5 stores in the Chicago area plus 1 online storefront. OEM and partnerships through distribution are also possible. Competition, it comes in 2 forms. The first is services. Services like massive online lost and found sites, data backup services, and phone insurance. These services are A, non-preventive. They don't help you if you just merely forget your phone at home. They're complex and difficult to use and inherently slow. Next type is low-carrier devices. These devices currently utilize GPS and RFID to find your items after you've lost them. These items are expensive. They're bulky and require you to carry an additional item. And their maximum battery life is 1/8 of our minimum battery life. We realize that we will have new entrants into this market, and we're going to outline a strategy for a sustainable competitive advantage. Number one, we're going to focus on our software being incredibly easy to use and easy to install. We'll use the time-tested strategy of carving ourselves out of market niche in business professionals and heavily marketing to that niche, blocking new entrants. We utilize software updates to make sure that our product is ahead of the competition. Here's our five-year financials. You see that in 5 years, we have an EBIT of $85 million. You notice the gap in revenue between years one and two. This is because in year one, we're selling direct and mainly focused on product development, while in year two, we rapidly ramp and scale to nationwide distribution through retail. Now, yes, these numbers may seem daunting, but after 5 years, we've sold a total of 11.3 million units, capturing 7.8% of our target market. And yes, we are confident in our business, but we are also realistic. Cost of goods sold for one unit is two tracker devices plus the software. It's $15.18 to us, where we sell it for an MSRP of $79.99. We came up with this price point through customer surveys done and based off of competitors' prices. Now, this table shows our price point sold to each of our distribution, and we have wide margins here for more price flexibility. And this is our funding timeline. We start out with $210,000 in friends and family. During this time, we're going to do product development. We're going to get the required certifications to release the product. We're going to recruit a management team, and we're going to get more intellectual property to protect us. During this time period, we'll be able to release an initial alpha product. Upon attaining this traction, we'll be able to raise $900,000 in angel VC capital, where we will continue product development and prepare for year two, where we rapidly ramp. Now, in year two, we take in $7 million in a capital injection, ramp up and scale to nationwide distribution through two retail chains. We'll utilize this money for heavy marketing and also form these strategic partnerships with those OEM deals that is so important. Our team is currently a team of geeks. Christian Smith is a mechanical engineer working at Tyco Electronics. Tyler Crane is getting his master's in computer science, and I'm currently an undergraduate electrical engineer. We have recruited an experienced entrepreneurial advisory board, and we'll be bringing on an experienced management team to take this business to its maximum potential. The one point I'd like to make about the current team is that we're three engineers. We can make this alpha product, and we have proven this today by showing you a prototype we have made with $0 in capital funding. So when choosing what is the most fundable idea today, consider these five things. Number one, we have shown you a functional product prototype. Two, we have filed a full utility patent with the patent lawyer. Three, we have figured out our distribution channels and already have a means of distributing this. Four, we have an entrepreneurial advisory board to help us in these early stages and recruit this management team. And finally, time for audience participation. Who here will buy this product for themselves or for a friend? Please raise your hands. We have customers who want to buy this product. So, in the end, Profound isn't about a business plan, a product, profit margins. It's about serving our customer and taking back that time spent searching for those keys in the couch, the wallet in yesterday's pants, the phone left on the kitchen counter. Together, we can take what has been lost and make it always found.
Very exciting presentation there. What is your sort of? You mentioned you need to get certification released for your first product. What is that?
So we have the initial Bluetooth certification because we're using Bluetooth and ultra low power Bluetooth to be exact. Okay. Then we have certification through each of the app stores. We're going to be first going through BlackBerry. So we just need certification for the BlackBerry app store to sell it through them. It's a matter of approving our software and make sure it's bug-free. Apple is a little bit more stringent. That's why we're going after them in the next phase, after we get BlackBerry, because they also require that our hardware also be approved, while BlackBerry does not currently.
Can you tell us a little bit how it works?
Tyler?
So we have software running on your smartphone, and we have a small device that you're going to buy. The two devices come as a package, and the devices are running ultra-low-power Bluetooth, and it's running on the Bluetooth connection already built in your phone, asking for the signal strength. And once the signal strength, we have an algorithm to check how strong the radio is, and once it reaches a certain level that the user can define the distance, the phone will ring. And you can attach as many devices as you want, set whatever sound files you want so you can distinguish from the devices and make sure you know what you're about to leave behind.
And how many different devices can you put that on? Two?
It's determined by the Bluetooth PicoNet size, which is currently up to, I think, 50 devices you can track simultaneously through one Bluetooth PicoNet.
But let's say in your example, you have it on your keys, chain, and your phone. Mm-hmm. I usually keep those together. So if I walk out of the house or if I somewhere and I misplaced my keys and my phone, I'm busted.
Can you walk me through your wake up? Because it helps me.
When I go to bed at night, I take my phone out, my wallet out, and my keys out and put them together.
Great. So you all put it in the same place,
in
right?
In the same place. But so if I walk out of the house and don't, well, I would know because I don't have my keys. But if I took a subway to work, which being green I will start to do once LA has a subway system, if I took a subway to work and then it wouldn't work because I'd walk out of the house and because they're all together, you wouldn't have any way to let me know.
There's with our device right now, if you forget all three items or lose all three items at the same exact time, we can't help you because it fails. But you will be forgetting your wallet and your keys. And so for looking at people driving to work, they'll be notified because they take their keys. Right. And if you need to buy anything or need your wallet for anything at all, you'll have your wallet on you. But if you forget all three items, and that's correct, everyone sets it on the same place when they go to sleep. So we can't help you there. But as far as thinking about losing all three items at the same time, people have thought about this, and for men at least, you have your keys and your phone in your front pocket and your wallet in your back. Your chance of losing all three items at the same exact instant are very slim. And then we found that actually women, we were concerned because they have everything in their purse, but women typically do not lose their purse, actually.
This is something that wasn't clear from your business plan, was this issue of, you know, how does a phone know it's lost? So what you're saying is you have to carry one item, whatever it is, on you at all times in order for this to work.
That is the idea, and the idea is that you'll always have your keys or your wallet or with the phone on you.
Can I ask you a margin question? Sorry, you ready?
No, go ahead.
That's right. So you have a pricing remember from $39 to $79. Have you priced out the component parts? Yeah. If so, and sourced them and build that up so you get an adequate margin on the product?
Sorry, can
margins cost of goods? So the cost of all the component pieces. You've got the couple of these, I guess, Bluetooth chips that are going to be attached, and then the software and everything that's downloaded to the phone.
Yes.
I presume the phone has to also have Bluetooth-enabled technology. So have you priced out the pieces that are going to make up your system, what that's going to cost you, and done some margin calculations?
Yes. I believe in the previous slide, I have that pie chart that breaks down the cost of each component plus the cost of manufacturing. The cost of manufacturing is the main cost of that is going to be in forming all the components together, because they have to go and get a machine to actually solder all the IMs onto the board. And then we have injection molding for the casing of this. And so that's the casing molding. And then once you have the injection mold from that initial capital investment, casings get very low cost. And then as we ramp and scale up to larger orders, our costs will go down. I have this price right now at per 1,000 units. And with our MSRP, we have that at $79.99. But as you can tell, these are our early projections. And so costs may go up. They may go down slightly, because I'm pricing this off of a Bluetooth chip of current BlueCore 6. We want to use a BlueCore 7, which is ultra-low power, this after current Bluetooth pricing.
What is the technology specifically? What type of chip?
We're using ultra-low power Bluetooth standards. Now, this is brand new mm-hmm. technology here.
Okay.
And basically, what is current Bluetooth skips over 24,000 or 2,400 frequencies uh-huh. per second. So that makes, and that's the Bluetooth standard of going through. This ultra-low power Bluetooth goes only through 37 frequencies mm-hmm. per second. And so this decreases the power. And that's why you haven't seen this item out yet.
I see. Okay.
That raises the question. So you're specifying a 2-year battery life.
Yes.
So that's based in part on a new battery technology or new chip technology?
New chip technology, because this number we got from the companies and how they showed it at these trade shows.
Okay.
What happens if your phone's off or on vibrate?
Well, we can override the software controls with our software. So if you set on vibrate, we can change that so that on our software it will ring on the loudest thing, no matter what. And then you can also change the ring on our software, like if you're at a presentation and you don't want this thing going off at you right now. And but if your phone's off, once again, our product does not work, because it assumes that your phone is always on and we're using this as the brains.
In your projections forward, you talk about entering the market on a direct sales basis initially, but then dropping that in the second year. Why are you dropping an ongoing business?
This is from our advisors, and saying that would AT&T let us continue a direct sales base with this while going and selling through a retail is a conflict of interest. So we want to go and keep a realistic projection as possible. So we drop that cash flow there.
Do you guys have to pay a license to have an app, Apple application, or with Research in Motion, or is that, and what is that built into your financial forecast?
Yeah, if you saw on the App Store, I think our margin was 72%. They do charge. Apple charges, 30%, but through. Through BlackBerry, we can sell it on our own and license ourselves, but still distribute through their app store. So that is figured into our financials, and that is a cost we're going to have to pay.
Talk about where you are right now in prototype design, beta testing. Where are you actually in the development path, and what are the critical kind of technical hurdles you've got to overcome still?
Right now, Tyler is making all the software right now. As you can see, this is not a BlackBerry. This is currently a Windows mobile phone that we have designed it for the initial product, just to get the proof of concept going. We're going to switch gears now and develop for the BlackBerry for the software. I'm currently making the device and getting all the components right. And so first, it's going to be normal Bluetooth with a larger battery size, and this initial product release will be out to mainly friends and family, so we can get the customer input and what they get like and not like about the product. And then when ultra-low power Bluetooth releases, we incorporate that in and release that product and then scale.
What's your time frame for that release of the low power product?
It's forecasted in October by Nordic Semiconductor and CSR.
That's the availability of the product or your finished product?
Oh, that's the availability of the chip. We forecast that our finished product will be in January of 2010.
How easy is it for the user to change the amount of space separation before the phone goes off?
Well, we're designing a simple touchscreen UI to go with the new smartphones, and you just load up the application, select the device with your finger, and then it'll say choose ring distance, and then there'll be ranges between like 0 to 3 feet, 3 to 6, 6 to 9, or whatever.
It's something as easy as changing from silent to vibrate to. And what about competition?
Well, there's no direct competitors in this market right now, and that's our unknown, is that we don't know what Samsung is doing right now, or there might be other startups tinkering around with this idea. That's why we've outlined a strategy for our implementation, and that's why we believe that bringing on an experienced entrepreneurial team is so vital to our success. And as far as the current competition, we have those low-carrier devices are the most similar to us, and you have to carry an extra device to track your items and make sure you don't lose anything. But it's kind of a catch-22 because then that's just another item to lose. So we have a clear competitive advantage, and those products have won multiple awards for their design.
I noticed in your business plan you talked about insurance as a possible competitor. I would think that if you went to one of these phone insurance companies and pitched this to them, they would give discounts if clients, buyers. So I don't see them as a competitor, but I see them as someone that can be a gateway for you guys to sell.
We absolutely agree with you.
Do you have any idea what the maximum range is on this at this point?
We're using class level 2 Bluetooth, so it's 30 feet. We want to go and send this. One of our advisors wants to use this to track his cats, actually. And they can be anywhere within this perimeter here.
Yeah.
And we can switch out and have devices that are using class level 1 on Bluetooth. So this goes out to 300 feet. It's a trade-off between battery size.
Thank you very much.
Screen price. Are you Shivani, Travis, and me? I'm Freddie. So let's get started. Here you can see in the picture an employee of a retail store. They receive every single morning a list of all the prices that they have to change in the store. That means that they go with this tool that you can see in the circle in the picture, and they go around the store looking for all these prices. So they print out the paper label from this tool and remove the old label, paper label, and stick the new one. The thing is that, as all we know, there's not just one label. There are tons of them in a retail store. And actually, there are thousands. And we think, that's not cool. That's not cool at all. That's not cool, why? That's not cool because there are 1,200 change prices per week per store. That's a lot of ink. That's a lot of paper. Also, that's a lot of time. 1,300 hours per year per store. That's time. Also, $37,000. So it's painful for your pocket, too, per year per store. So we thought ourselves, what if we use that cool technology called electronic paper, and we could build an electronic label? So we could stick it in those shelves for every product and stick it on the shelf. That's cool. So We just imagine that we have an employee in the headquarters of, I don't know, Albertsons or Safeway, and they log in the software. They look for the location of the store. They look for the product, and they set the new price. So wirelessly, controlling from the computer, we send all this information to the screen, to the electronic label. So before it was 150, now it's 120. No ink and no paper. So we're going green. That's cool, again. So what are we offering? The basic thing and the most important, it's strategic benefits for customers. Why? There's no more price errors. So the price you will see in the electronic paper, on the electronic label, it's the same price that you will see in when you check out all your stuff. Also, they can play around with that. And if they see, okay, Wednesday morning, there's not a lot of people in the store, so they can do the happy hour, or they can get rid of the products that are about to expire. And instead of getting zero, they would get like fourth of the price or something like that. And again, no waste of ink and paper. Also, we're helping to cut costs, especially in labor. And our estimates is that they would break even, like the return of our investment 100% within 3 years. About our business model, of course, what we want to do is to lower the barriers of our customers. So we would charge modestly for our hardware, for our electronic labels. There will be a 20% margin, $16 would be the estimate of the price per unit. What we want to do is go for the recurring revenue. This is the software, $5,000 fee per store per year. And that is what it's going to make sustainable our business in the future. So about our product, we will be able to show a definition with a brief definition of the product with a price so the people can relate it easily. Also synchronize their database and the spreadsheets so they can handle it easily, all the information that they already have. Customize the electronic labels in size and in colors for big shipments. That's the coolest thing. Since we're using low power consumption energies, electronic paper and the wireless protocol that we're using, we could power up all these devices without batteries. And also, we should be able to show graphics and pictures so it's more appealing for the customer. We don't just care about the retail store. We care about the final customer because if the Dayton 7, the electronic shelf label surpassed $65 million. There's an estimation for through 2012 of 17% of growth. We would target for the first 5 years of life of the product life, 770 stores. And that's translated in financials forecast. If we hit that target, we will break even within 2 years, 0.5. And by the fifth year, we will be with an EBITDA of $10.7 million.
What do I have to buy? Say I'm going to put into a 7-Eleven, and I'm the manager. What do I have to buy from you to get started?
The software?
All the parts.
Why do you have to buy it?
Yes. What are the pieces I'm going to buy from you to set the system up to get started?
Oh, the labels, the return labels, and the software.
And the Zigbee device you mentioned, I've already got that in my
store. It's in it, yeah.
It's in the labels? I don't think so.
The label has a receiver for it.
Right.
Yeah.
What do you have to hook to your computer to make it transmit to the label?
It's wireless.
So it's just a wireless transmitter?
It's wireless. I mean, the store will have a computer, and we have the transceiver from there.
Mm-hmm.
And all the electronic label, it's wireless.
So it's the same.
So we just stick on the shelf.
Same yeah, okay. Gotcha. How much distance will that carry in a store? I mean, would you have to have sub-transmitters or?
The protocol that we're using, it has a range of, I think in meters, I'm sorry, it's 100 meters.
What I mean.
And it can go through pipes and everything, so it's not a problem.
Okay, so not a problem.
Yeah.
I'd like to ask about, I don't know retailing, I don't know consumer products very well. All my life has been in technology. Is it factually true that there are that many price changes?
Yeah, actually.
You've done research on this? Yeah.
Fortunately, we got a contact from the former VP of operation from Safeway, and the lady gave us a number on how many price changes per store in Safeway. And we mentioned that in the appendix of the business plan. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Okay.
And I think the price, I think there are, I cannot remember the exact number, but it's around 521 per hour or something like that. I cannot remember the exact number.
But
Sorry about that.
They only have about 7,000 to 8,000 items. I thought a typical store. Is that correct? Am I wrong on that?
You mean 700?
Yes, in a large, large Safeway store, we'll only have 5,000 to 7,000 items. And what you're really telling me, or what I'm getting from this, is that you have price changes on well in excess of 10% every day.
Yeah.
I just don't quite. I don't know the business. Maybe that's what's wrong. I don't know the business.
Actually, our numbers is we have numbers that there are more than 7,000 labels per store.
I would believe that. I have one.
And yeah, there are a lot of. I mean, there's that comes from the source that we have in from Safeway.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Right now, she's a VP of operations from Long Drugs.
Right.
So it's a pretty. She
large
gave
number.
Us a lot of information. It was. Good information.
I never, until I read your plan, I never had given a thought to electronic labels, but I think in 10 years that's probably what everything will be. What stuck out to me is security. So I'm sitting in Walmart headquarters in Arkansas, and I get mad at my boss, and I'm in charge of changing the watch prices. So I'm on my way out, and I say, okay, instead of Rolexes being $10,000 at all the Walmarts all over the country, let's have a fire. So let's see what happens to inventory for the $10. How are you guys going to – I mean, if I'm a boss, I would be petrified that you can change prices this easily. I mean, if a guy labeling in one store does it, your losses are, you can manage. But if centrally someone's doing that at stores that you want to be in, how do you make sure that these sort of things don't occur?
I completely understand. And that comes with a wireless protocol. It allows us to do some bits of encryption. So that is an extra security that we are adding to this product, because we know that if someone smart can break into your product, we're out of business too. It's so painful for a customer. If you are not reliable, we lose everything. So we thought about that, and we have the wireless protocol that has to work on that to be more reliable and secure
So right now you don't have. Right now, if someone has authorization, they can make the changes without safeguards. Right now, the way the program is set up, you don't have the safeguards in to ensure that someone who's just either makes an honest mistake or is malevolent to catch those sort of things.
Our software, if you want to use that, you need to log in first. So you will give in a username and a password. So that's the first part. You can protect the benefit of our customers.
Yeah, the idea is that keeps track of everyone that access to a software. It has to be in the list of the people that has the authority to make those changes. I didn't understand. I'm sorry, the question before.
You're saying on the individual use of security, you can encrypt the signal.
Yeah.
So that's ability to gain. So from hacking, if somebody else hacking in through your wireless system, your encryption could do that. What's the size of this tag? What are you predicting the size of the actual tag itself?
The thing is that the size should be like 5 inches. And also, what we,
what we're willing to do is like not have just one size, but like three sizes, because we have to be able to show enough information to make easy to the customer to understand everything. But with the thing is that there are also some labels that the letters are so small. So we have to come up with something that the letters are big enough to the people, like easy to understand, and see all the features of the product. And we one major point is that we don't want, we won't have to scroll down all the information. So it's just one spot. In one spot, you can see the price and the letters. So we'll be like this size of 5 inches or 6 inches. Yeah. That will be the size.
What's your competitive pricing? What's your competitors out there for now?
I think the cheapest product is Artier. They're a company in San Jose, and their product, the cost of their product is $5 per piece. And I think they are going to give them 30 to 40% of the profit gross margin of their product. It should be around $8 per unit. That's the cheapest one. And there's a few competitors. It's another competitor in UK called ZBD Solution. Their product, I think, is the best product so far in the industry. And they charge it around $20 or $20 to $25. It depends on the size of the product and also all the information. And they just have the pilot run with a UK company called Tesco. Yeah, I think it's Tesco, and they provide multi-sized product to their different shelves, so they have different price, and I think that's the chief competitors, the price of our competitors.
From your competitors, what are their marketing strategies? You talk about various things. It seems to me this ability to change prices rapidly versus saving the money of changing the prices seems to be a key marketing item. Are they marketing to that, or can they even do that?
I think our tier, they are in trial mode with the two U.S. Food chains, and what they are trying to do, I think they have a long-term relationship with that two customers. So they have run the pilot run with those two chains for a while, and I think their marketing strategy and their marketing effort is actually on the synchronized pricing strategy. So it's actually what we are doing. But ZBD, I think ZBD, their competitive edge so far is on the best hardware. They provide the best label. And they're also using e-paper technology. So their display looks very pretty. And they get a lot of good feedback from the pilot run in Europe. Yeah.
In terms of system development, how far along are you? For example, have you done a demonstration in a store of some sort to show how it works? If not, where are you in the development stage?
Sadly, we're working on the first phase of the prototype. We have the transceiver, but we're working on to get the sample, the engineer sample of the e-ink. And sometimes when students are asking for engineer samples, they don't take you for real. And it's hard to take that. And we're working on that. Once with the engineers that they are in our advisory board, they're just maybe overconfident, but they're like, man, if you give me an engineer sample by today, within 1 week, we have the prototype. But we need the engineer sample right now.
Do I understand that this thing does not require its own a battery? So how is it powered?
Yeah, that's the long vision. Right now there's a technology called energy harvesting that for devices that they don't spend a lot of energy, that would be our device, it's low power consumption, we could power up wirelessly.
So you're transmitting the power over the wireless system. Mm-hmm.
And also for our product, we are using Zigbee technology and the e-paper technology. They are both, I think they are both low power consumption. So that can validate our assumption about we can power up wirelessly.
Yeah. In your business plan, and you did a good job of detailing the strengths and weaknesses of the competition, and one of your strengths is this harvest energy. What's to prevent your competitors from going to this technology also on the energy?
Actually, I don't know. Yeah. That's the best answer, because I could say, yeah, we're once we get the prototype, we will patent it. But that doesn't mean that they couldn't do it without another way to do it. So yeah,
I think currently all the technology we are using are pretty new technology, both e-ink technology and also Zigbee technology. So if they want to imitate our product, they have to change a lot of things about their product development. So that means they have to give up what they have right now and to reinvent another product, because you need to redesign and also develop the product to integrate the what we mentioned here, the power harvesting technology, to the product.
One of the concerns in reading the in your numbers and stuff is the very low margin you have on your product, on the actual label itself. Can you address this? Is there ability to increase that margin significantly?
Currently, I think in the first few years, what we are trying to do is that we're trying to lower the barrier to apply our product, and therefore we need to earn some customer first, and then we earn our own reputation in the industry. And in the future, we can integrate more features to the product, and then we are going to charge a higher margin based on the feedback from our customers. I think, but in the first few years, I think the most important thing is that we need to get the first customer first, and then go to the next step.
So just as a follow-up to that last point, it's a marketing question on your go-to-market strategy. If you've done market research, what do you think you're going to need to do? You had some very large companies like Costco up there. What do you think you're going to need to do to convince one of those large customers to adopt your system?
Free, yeah.
I think I did a research about the decision process of those companies. And if you want to get contact with them, I think direct sales would be the best way and in the first phase. And what we are trying to do is that we are going to send a few demos and also the free samples of our product to their headquarters to try to contact the CFO and also the CTO of those companies to convince them to let us to give a pitch to them. And then if they allow us to give a pitch, we will bring our prototype and also our software to the headquarters to show how they work. And also another thing we are trying to approach them, we are going to bring our product to the 2010 International Electronic Consumer Shows. There's a trade show in Las Vegas. And at that time, our target customer's representative is going to be there to find the product that fit their approach. So at that time, if they show interest of our product, I think that's another opportunity we can approach them. So far, we have these two things. And I think the last one we can do is just try to connect those industry analysts and the industry journals about the retail technology to let them know what we are trying to do. And hopefully, I think each of our target customers, they will have someone to read the journals every week. And so they can take a look at our solution and maybe show interest with us. Yeah, I think these are three marketing techniques.
We're pretty sure also that once we connect with all these, because this is a decision that it's about a CEO decision when you have to install. This is a pretty important investment. So our expectation is that they ask us, like, install 1,000 of your labels for free. If it does work, then we will buy everything. But we expect that. We will have to install all the system and see how it works, because they want to know that, okay, you do your prototype and everything, but I want to know how it works in my store.
The last thing I want to mention is we have a backup plan for that. If we cannot win a big customer at the very beginning, we plan to sell our product to those paper label producers, and because they have the connection, the distribution channel with those our target customers, and at that time we can complement each other, because I think we are very confident that the electronic shelf label is going to happen pretty soon. So at that time, they are facing the risk of being kicked out by those CBD solution or the RTR. So at that time, if we complement each other, they can use our technology, we can use their distribution channel. So that's the backup plan if we cannot earn a big customer at the very beginning.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.